Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. If you like to wander in the woods, do you return to familiar paths? Do you try to be alert to small changes in the plant growth there? Or do you tend to be lost in your own thoughts? Either way, how do you decide which way to go when you arrive at a fork in your path? Today's episode celebrates wandering, and we'll take a slight detour to consider roving. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, Robert Frost wrote, and in one of his poems he reflects on how he chose one path over another. Curiously, his poem's title does not refer to the speaker's view of the path taken. Instead, Frost's title, The Road Not Taken, suggests regret in what the speaker missed. This is Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though, as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. It's a yellow wood, so we may presume it's the fall, and as one tree wise reader noted, most likely yellow leaves from birches or alder in Frost, New England. Pausing at the fork, the speaker stares down one path, but decides to take the other. Why? We might expect the speaker to highlight contrast between the path taken and the one not taken, but he remarks, there's essentially no difference. We may think we're being told an example of choice-making, of how, in retrospect, we realize an earlier decision we made, perhaps one that seemed almost trivial at the time, led to crucial long-term results. Maybe in terms of moving to a new region, selecting a specific career, meeting someone we fall in love with, all based on a seemingly trivial turn down a new path. And random choices in the past might have led to important personal claims on our identity. But Frost is not saying that. He's playing with us, especially having a joke on readers seeking serious insight. The paths are nearly identical. Both are worn down nearly the same by walkers. Both have fallen leaves strewn over them. First, he says he will come back another day and try the road not taken, but then admits he's probably deceiving himself. Quotes, I doubted if I should ever come back. The fourth and final stanza is most curious. He leaps into the future. He expects he will create a narrative about the alleged significance of his choice. He says that in the future, when he talks about this choice of one road over another, he will claim to others one road was less traveled by, though he told us earlier that's really not true. In his closing line, he says, taking one road over another made all the difference, as though in the future, when talking to others, he will speak as though sharing an important life lesson. It sounds grandiose, yet he's told us earlier, it did not make any meaningful difference. Frost may be mocking himself, as though when he grows older, he expects to become a hot air sage, a bit of a windbag. With all its claims and counterclaims, the poem warns us, don't take him too seriously. In the future, he will project a meaning on his impulsive decision made when wandering, a meaning that, in truth, he knows does not apply. Again, this is Robert Frost, The Road Not Taken. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, then took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. To help us memorize the poem, Frost works with a simple rhyme scheme. In each five-line stanza, the first, third, and fourth lines rhyme, and the second and fifth lines rhyme. For example, would, stood, could, and travel both and undergrowth from stanza one, and sigh, I, by, and ages hence and the difference from the final stanza. But really, what difference did his choice of paths make? In his own peculiar way, the poem quietly celebrates wandering. There's no reason to look for a larger meaning. Roughly a century before Frost made his claims about wandering in the woods of New England, British poet John Clare complained that he could no longer wander the English countryside as he did as a boy. The reason? In the early 19th century in England, after many years of legal restrictions, the widespread English countryside transformed into fenced zones of private property, woods and pastures acquired by the well-to-do. John Clare's The Moors, a lengthy poem, expresses his disappointment over these changes. I'll read just parts of it to give you a sense of how he thinks his movements have been restricted. This is from John Clare's The Moors. Far spread the moory ground, a level scene, bespread with rush and one eternal green that never felt the rage of blundering plough, though centuries wreath spring's blossoms on its brow. Still meeting plains that stretched them far away in unchecked shadows of green, brown, and gray. Unbounded freedom ruled the wandering scene, nor fence of ownership crept in between to hide the prospect of the following eye. Its only bondage was the circling sky. Now this sweet vision of my boyish hours, free as spring clouds and wild as summer flowers, is faded all. A hope that blossomed free and hath been once, no more shall ever be. Enclosure came and trampled on the grave of labor's rights and left the poor a slave. Enclosure came, he complains, and John Clare is historically accurate with this early 19th century poem. A later writer provides some context. The English Enclosure Acts, quotes, gave to powerful individuals land that had long been collectively farmed, grazed, and administered, erasing villages and villagers and their self-determination and prosperity. These measures transformed the rural working class into an uprooted, dispossessed population who would swell cities as the Industrial Revolution's labor force. Communal property was carved up into private parcels. The consequences were personal for Clare and other wanderers, and also political for his community. Lives connected to the land were disrupted. Rural traditions maintained for centuries abruptly ended. John Clare represents many wanderers, distraught that restrictions in land ownership now inhibit their movement, just as you would feel if your favorite forest paths were carved up by logging companies and barbed wire blocked your outdoor movements, or if flat fields you used to wander on were purchased by an individual who built a golf course there. No wonder he views his boyhood rambles nostalgically. New limits restrict even the range of sheep and cows. As the poem continues, John Clare contrasts the freedom to wander in his boyhood with the rapid changes of the recent few years. His landscape has been transformed. Again, this is another passage from John Clare's The Moors. Fence now meets fence in owner's little bounds of field and meadow, large as garden grounds. In little parcels, little minds to please, with men in flocks imprisoned ill at ease. Each little path that led its pleasant way, as sweet as morning leading night astray, where little flowers bloomed round a varied host, that travel felt delighted to be lost, nor grudged the steps that he had taken as vain, when right roads traced his journeys, and again, nay, on a broken tree, he'd sit a while, to see the moors and fields and meadows smile, sometimes with cowslaps smothered, then all white with daisies, then the summer's splendid sight of cornfields crimson o'er the headache bloomed, like splendid armies for the battle plumed. He gazed upon them with wild fancy's eye, as fallen landscapes from an evening sky. These paths are stopped. The rude Philistine's thrall is laid upon them and destroyed them all. Each little tyrant with his little sign shows where man claims earth glows no more divine, but paths to freedom and to childhood dear, a board sticks up to notice no road here. And on the tree with ivy overhung, the hated sign by vulgar taste is hung, as though the very birds should learn to know when they go there they must no further go. Thus with the poor, scared freedom bade goodbye, and much they feel it in the smothered sigh, and birds and trees and flowers without a name all sighed when lawless laws enclosure came, and dreams of plunder in such rebel schemes have found too truly that they were but dreams. Fence now meets fence in owner's little bounds, John Clare says. Labeled the peasant poet, he never became one of those owners. Robert Frost and John Clare addressed wandering in their own ways. Lord Byron puts a spin on the concept, using the term roving to suggest more than just shifting from place to place. Think of it as straying from a fixed path, from a designated route. And there are moral implications. Someone who has a roving eye is viewed suspiciously, as though the straying that person does might be from one relationship to another, hastily, promiscuously. That, I take it, is the meaning intended in our next poem. It's a 12-line rhyming poem, structured with 3 stanzas, each stanza a sentence. The speaker declares he feels emotional and sexual exhaustion. I wager you have heard this poem before, though it may have been many years ago. If we care to understand the poem autobiography, this is Lord Byron, age 29, claiming he's worn out and ready to change his ways. Lord Byron's So We'll Go No More A-Roving. So we'll go no more a-roving so late into the night, though the heart be still as loving and the moon be still as bright. For the sword outwears its sheath, and the soul wears out the breast, and the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself have rest. Though the night was made for loving, and the day returns too soon, yet we'll go no more a-roving by the light of the moon. One feature linking the poems on today's episode is their use of rhyme, sometimes very obvious, like Byron's breast and rest, soon and moon. In this poem, at least, there's no effort by Byron to be clever with his rhymes. He wants to use the rhymes for their mnemonic effect, to help us remember the lines, not to dazzle us with his wit. I suggest that the poem could be read autobiographically. Yet Byron's title and 2 slight variations on the title within the poem refer to a we. Is that the royal we? Does Byron think of himself as the impossible-to-match model of reckless abandonment? Or does we refer to Byron and his reader? We all might feel at some point exhausted by our pleasure-seeking and in need of a dramatic change in habits. Byron included this poem in a February 1817 letter to his friend, the Irish writer Thomas More. Many years later, one knowledgeable reader said Byron composed it, quotes, in the Lenten aftermath of a period of late-night carousing during the carnival season in Venice, end quotes. Well, of course, Venice is not named in the poem, and carousing sounds like a polite euphemism. Byron leaves unstated what specifically led to this abandonment of all that may constitute roving, itself a polite-sounding euphemism. So the setup is that Byron informs his literary comrade Thomas More that he must change his ways. He claims to be worn out by his hedonistic roving, physically and emotionally worn out. Well, this poetic declaration was premature. More than half a year later, as his debauchery continued, Byron estimated he enjoyed trysts with more than 200 women. He was a busy man, and a man of contradictions. In this poem, he reminds me of St. Augustine, who in his early years was a libertine, even fathering a child when he was young. St. Augustine sought spiritual strength to restrain his own roving habits. He wrote of his prayer to his God, quotes, "Give me chastity, but not yet," end quotes. Augustine wanted his roving to continue before he reformed. Byron's speaker feels no moral qualms. He simply acknowledges his body and heart are worn out. But how serious is he? Again, this is Byron's "So We'll Go No More A-Roving." So we'll go no more a-roving so late into the night, though the heart be still as loving and the moon be still as bright. For the sword outwears its sheath, and the soul wears out the breast, and the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself have rest. Though the night was made for loving, and the day returns too soon, yet we'll go no more a-roving by the light of the moon. As noted, Byron's speaker sounds worn down, though he does not specify what he did that wore him out. Does our next poem trigger fond thoughts of being young and exhilarated, even when sleep-deprived? Recuerdo, the poem's title, is Spanish for reminiscence. This is Edna St. Vincent Millay's poem, Recuerdo. We were very tired. We were very merry. We had gone back and forth all night on the ferry. It was bare and bright and smelled like a stable. But we looked into a fire. We leaned across a table. We lay on a hilltop underneath the moon, and the whistles kept blowing, and the dawn came soon. We were very tired. We were very merry. We had gone back and forth all night on the ferry. And you ate an apple, and I ate a pear from a dozen of each we had bought somewhere. And the sky went wan, and the wind came cold, and the sun rose dripping, a bucketful of gold. We were very tired. We were very merry. We had gone back and forth all night on the ferry. We hailed, "Good morrow, mother," to a shawl-covered head, and bought a morning paper, which neither of us read. And she wept, "God bless you," for the apples and pears, and we gave her all our money but our subway fares. Edna St. Vincent Millay's Recuerdo. Most of us should be able to retrieve from our memory bank some incident from our past when we felt young and exhilarated, even though sleep-deprived. We were very tired. We were very merry. The term "we" is used over a dozen times in this short poem, though who the "we" might be is not identified. We know it refers to the speaker and her companion. You ate an apple, and I ate a pear. But the companion is not identified, except to note that the speaker and companion operate in tandem, speaking to the shawl-covered woman, buying a newspaper and ignoring it, giving the woman their fruit and their money. This is not an account of a burst of romantic feeling developed by the speaker for another while riding the ferry at night, as romantic as that repetitious activity might sound to us. But it is an account of shared, heightened emotions provoked by the ferry ride, the shift to the hilltop setting underneath the moon, and the other incidents the poem recalls. their exuberance has a ripple effect. The old woman is so moved by their spontaneous gift of fruit that she declares, "God bless you," and weeps and is rewarded by a further gift of their money. The woman's sudden burst of emotion enhances the fairy rider's sense of joy. The speaker and her companion are not driven by any goal. They're riding back and forth all night on the ferry. They don't have a purpose for what they're doing. No plan, no intended destination. When the speaker and her companion lie on their backs underneath the moon in the early morning hours, we may trust they contemplate what they miss when they're usually indoors and asleep at that time. Let's hear the poem once again. We were very tired. We were very merry. We had gone back and forth all night on the ferry. It was bare and bright and smelled like a stable, but we looked into a fire. We leaned across a table. We lay on a hilltop underneath the moon, and the whistles kept blowing, and the dawn came soon. We were very tired. We were very merry. We had gone back and forth all night on the ferry. And you ate an apple, and I ate a pear, from a dozen of each we had bought somewhere. And the sky went wan, and the wind came cold, and the sun rose dripping, bucket full of gold. We were very tired. We were very merry. We had gone back and forth all night on the ferry. We hailed, "Good morrow, mother," to a shawl-covered head, and bought a morning paper, which neither of us read. And she wept, "God bless you," for the apples and pears, and we gave her all our money but our subway fares. Edna St. Vincent Millay's Recuerdo. No internal reference allows us to date the poem. Ferries still cross the waters around New York City and elsewhere. The night sky may seem as exotic today as it did in 1919 when the poem was first published. And the purchased newspaper is left unread, so the historical moment is not commented on. In fact, it's absolutely ignored. The speaker gives herself over to the wonderful strangeness of the night, to the natural world, to the old woman. That's all that matters from this long night of wandering. And that wandering will come to an end when they board the subway. This and other episodes of Poems for Company are always available at KMUN.org and on a wide variety of apps. Our theme music is Philip Auberg's Going to the Sun from a CD Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. I will return next month with another theme-based poetry show. Thanks for listening.